listening to WYXR 91.7 FM Memphis, powered by the Crosstown Radio Partnership between the Daily Memphian, Crosstown Concourse, and the University of Memphis. We are raised by sound.
Hello and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. This is Father Ollie Rencher of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. I'm here as a guest of Bishop Phoebe Rofe. She's allowed me to have her show this morning. And I'm gathered here with Dan Conaway, who is a member of Grace St. Luke's Church. Every Thursday at 8 a.m., this program, Faithfully Memphis, is an opportunity to speak with interesting people and to learn about the role that faith plays in their lives. And we are broadcast here on WYXR 91.7 FM in Memphis, Tennessee. I said earlier about wonderfully interesting people, and Dan Conaway is my guest today. But before we get started, just to say that Grace St. Luke's is an Episcopal church in Midtown Memphis. We have been thriving since 1940 as a merger of Grace Church and St. Luke's Church. And as a part of the Diocese of West Tennessee, we are delighted to be a part of such a thriving church. And I'd like for Dan to just take a quick moment to introduce himself, and then we will have a moment, and even on the radio, we have a prayer. So Dan, off you go, just to introduce yourself.
Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be here with Ollie and delighted to be here on this station. It's a marvelous service for the city of Memphis and a lot of fun for everyone, a lot of entertaining people. I hope we can be entertaining for you this morning. My name is Dan Conaway. I am a lifelong Memphian. I have a career in advertising, and for the last 12 years or so, I've been a columnist and now a columnist for the Daily Memphian, and a member, as Ollie said, of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church. And so let's kick this thing off.
So today our topic is race matters, cemeteries, theaters, churches, cities, special spaces and places. And just when you think you've heard it all, there could be some more. There's so much more that we could talk about, but this is a time of storytelling, of reflecting on the life that we have in this world, the things that connect us, the things that have us broken, the opportunities that we have as a human family to create the kingdom of God in this world and to be mindful of who and whose we are as the image of God. And so with that, I'd like to begin us with the prayer. Gracious God, we give you thanks and praise for the gift of life, for this day, for this time, for this space. Be with us as we engage conversation. Be with those who are suffering in mind and body and spirit anywhere in this world. Help us as the church, help us as anyone who is listening to be the ones who are beacons of love, of compassion, of justice, and are icons of another way of being the beloved. Amen.
Amen.
So I have a bit of sinus congestion this morning, so as you listen and you wonder what's going on, I'm fine. Just have a little sinus.
He won't be singing.
I won't be singing. So thinking for just a moment about this topic of race matters and cemeteries and theaters, churches, cities, special spaces and places, I'm reminded that Dan and I, as we have come to know each other, we are both in the same parish, and we have learned a lot about what we have in common, not just our faith, but we also have the dilemma, as I often call it, of race and reconciliation, the lack of it, and how we are challenged by that, and we have been for centuries in this world. But Dan and I also like cemeteries. Since I was a little boy growing up in Clarksdale, Mississippi, one of my pastimes included riding my bicycle to cemeteries and putting it either on the side gate and wandering around, sometimes riding it through the cemetery and stopping at different places, because I was always fascinated by, no pun intended, the peace that was taking place in that space and how wonderful that was. And there was something calming about that, something hopeful about that, believe it or not, and something very invitational about living life to the fullest, mindful that those who had gone before me had been laid to rest, their bodies at least had been laid to rest. And Dan and I learned that we had that in common, and he will have some opportunity to talk about his work with cemeteries. But of course, churches are places of meaning, and cities like Memphis are places of meaning, and all are special, and all are holy because they are inhabited by sacred people. And so as we prepare to go into some really lively conversation, there's a great song that I thought would be nice for us to hear, and it's called For What It's Worth. If you listen closely to the words, several weeks ago, it was actually after the announcement of the now president, I offered a sermon on the Sunday after that announcement, and the words seemed fitting for the fractured society in which we live and move and have our being. So just meditate on these words, and you might get to hear at another point in our segment.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Being drawn, nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Day for the heat, a thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
So, Dan, in thinking about this topic of race matters, you have written most recently a book with Otis Sanford, In a Colorful Place, Seasoned Opinions About Memphis, About Home, About Life. And you and Otis spend some wonderful time reflecting, reflecting on your relationship, reflecting on the city of Memphis, reflecting on how we are polarized, but also what we have in common. But I'm curious As a person of faith, what is it about the dilemma of race that troubles you, that invites you, that encourages you? Because you've spent a lot of time writing about it, reflecting inwardly, being in community with others about it. What is it about race and that dilemma that you might just offer as some words of...
Well, I think it's a matter of awareness. Well, it's a matter of everything in this city, certainly. But it's a matter of awareness of your place in the city and your place in the world and the relationship we all have with each other. And it's not a separate relationship. It's a shared relationship. And the city I grew up in was actually two cities, one black and one white. And although we shared the city, we didn't share the city. There was a shitty city they had and a city we had. And being aware of that is something that has marked my life. I noticed it then, but not to the extent that I notice it now, because it's, forgive the expression, but it colors our world. Mm-hmm. It still does. We still struggle with it. We still struggle with a separateness rather than a togetherness. And it is something that we have to be constantly aware of every day. It's not something that goes away. It's something that you have to be aware of, and you have to be constantly looking for a way to share your experience with others and for them to be able to share theirs with you as a oneness rather than a separateness. And it's a very difficult thing to do. We still try to do it as a city. But I often say that if Memphis can figure out how to solve that problem, or at least see a way forward, this city more than just about any other city in the country could be a model for the rest of the country in doing that. So I remain hopeful. I've been hopeful my entire adult life, and I still remain hopeful. I see progress, and I see us going back. And then I see progress, and I see us going back. So it's both frustrating and rewarding. So it's something that continues.
Well, thank you. Dan, I share that sentiment of I'm hopeful, and then also I see us going back. And a word you used earlier, oneness, of how we are one, how we are connected, and the construct of the Imago Dei, the image mm-hmm. of God, in which we all are created. That concept has always stumped us because of who we are just as human beings. How is it that another human being could be having the same needs or have the same feelings or experience the same things in the world? How is it that we are connected one to another as the image of God? We've never fully gotten that. And so we stay in our zones, we stay in our pockets, in a place where we are being invited to cross the lines, mm-hmm. To realize that when we cross those lines, the fears that are natural are not warranted fears, because the other person, as I see it, and this is where I find myself often struggling and trying to make sense of the senselessness that takes place around bigotry and hatred and white supremacy, and the list goes on, is the other person is the image of God.
Well, I think the problem is that people do see clearly that they are made in the image of God. Just that fellow over there is not.
Right.
That's they're comfortable with that.
Right.
And if they're comfortable with that, I am in the image of God and you are not, then they have missed the point, I think.
Right.
And we all have that. It's about the capacity. Least of us, not the other.
That's right. And we do, each of us, you and I and everyone else, has the capacity to be the one who's not just in that prejudicial place, but in that bigoted place for whatever reason. That's a part of our brokenness. So something that you said earlier is that we have to strive every day for this to be different. Because if we aren't conscious of how embedded division is and systems in which we travel and how we came into our dilemma, we can fall, we can be the ones who take it back, right? Even as we're hoping and seeing progress be made, and we won't even know we're doing it.
Right.
And so that's the complicated nature, I would just say, of race. And thinking about some of your writings, if there's a particular part of your book, you've written also, you know, I'm a Memphian, which is a wonderful compilation of your life as a Memphian and things that you have written about. I would love to see if you have any excerpts or sharings that you could offer here on the program this morning.
I'd like to, maybe let me just read you about an adventure that I had in 1964 that maybe has something to do with a lot of this in this city. It's called Paradise Found. Just about any weekend, anybody in the Gantt button-down crowd could catch a concert at the Coliseum or Ellis Auditorium, crash a party at Clearpool, or hear a great band in a gym somewhere in Weegentown. This was Memphis in the early 60s. You could see Elvis at a stoplight, Jerry Lee in a restaurant, and listen to Willie Billy on the radio waiting in line for auto inspection right in front of Sam the Sham's club. But this weekend was different. This was Club Paradise. Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters were sharing the stage. The Little Red Rooster was going to take on the Hoochie Coochie Man. Ba-ba-ba-bump. One would moan at midnight while the other got his mojo working. Ba-ba-ba-bump. And we were going. Way down there, down where we'd never been, in the middle of where we weren't supposed to go. We weren't, however, telling our parents. There was a limit to our courage. We were big, bad, and ready. Nobody was going to mess with us. Duke was the oldest, pushing 16, 5'11", and all of a buck 65. I was 2 weeks past 15, about 5'9", and a buck 50. His little brother Chris finished out the threesome at barely 14, 5 and not much, and the Zippo in my pocket weighed more than he did. Their parents were going out, so we stole their mother's car. Duke drove with no license. I handled the city map under the dome light with no clue, and Chris was in charge of the radio. After a few wide-eyed wrong turns, we slid that East Memphis station wagon into the Club Paradise parking lot on Georgia Avenue, eased through the door, and paid our cover. Three slices of very white bread were in somebody else's kitchen. Oh, the dogs begin to bark and the hound begin to howl, Howling Wolf growled from somewhere up front, and a table full of folks asked us to join them. Somebody handed me a big brown bottle. A big woman gave Chris a hug, and all of us started howling and laughing. Oh, watch out, strange kind people, 'cause Little Red Rooster is on the prowl, Howling Wolf sang, and the rest of the night was a song. Way down there where we'd never been, in the middle where we weren't supposed to go, everything was different and the same. Our lives were in different worlds, our futures sharing common ground, completely independent of each other and utterly dependent. Sometimes it seems we live then and live now in parallel dimensions. There is real magic when nights like this occur, when we are bound by laughter, by music, by what we share rather than what we fear. We got home, got the car back in the garage as if nothing had changed. But at least one night, everything had, and it seemed everything could. I'm a Memphian, and I've been to Club Paradise. That that evening changed me. It made me realize that we share more than we don't share. And as scared to death as we were when we walked in that place accepted us. And if we can turn the tables and do the same, I thought even then and still remain thinking that now, that Memphis is one of the friendliest places on earth, one of the warmest places on earth. People in Memphis can talk to each other about anything in small groups, and they do. Anybody can come up to anybody and start a conversation. Anybody can start laughing. It's when we try to do that in larger groups, when we try to do that outside of a comfort level of two or three or four, when we start to threaten the arrangement, is when the trouble starts. But if we could do what we do in small groups in large measure, we could change everything.
Okay. Wow, Dan, that was that's a great segue into a next question, because I was about to ask how do you see it? My thoughts have always been that small groups allow for more relationship.
Absolutely.
And in the small group, though, what is important, I would say, is courage. So you can have a small group where everyone is, quote, the same and won't challenge the other.
Mm-hmm.
You can also have small groups where there is a variety of conversation, of opinion, but it will require courage, particularly, I would say, around race.
Absolutely.
Race is that odd part of no one wanting to own the sinfulness that comes with that, the oppression that one can do to another and not know that they're doing it. And so it is that part of us in Memphis, in New York, in mm-hmm. Berkeley, wherever.
In Timbuktu.
In Timbuktu, that it makes it that hush moment. And often the person who's doing the judging isn't even as aware as to where she or he may be around their own growth. And so where I'm going with this is, when you think about small groups and large groups, why do you think we don't have the courage to get to that place
I can actually address that, because it's one of the most frustrating things of my experience. When you do what I've done for a career, when you're in advertising, promotion, marketing, things like that, you get involved with a lot of big things, things that are going to change this, that, or the other, movements of one kind or another. And you find yourself in rooms of people that are very different, confronting a shared problem. Mm. Memphis has been doing that for my entire adult life and before that. But what's frustrating is you reach some point of accord, you reach some way forward, you reach some idea that everybody can share. And then somebody gets up and they go to the door and they say, all right, I'm with you and I'm going to help as much as I can. But you realize when I leave here, I can't say that. It's that same fear and that same courage, because they all have constituencies, white and black, young and old, whatever that constituency may be. And they're afraid that they may lose their constituency should they show that they're willing to join the other side in a joint effort to change. As a result, things change incrementally, but they don't change in big ways as they might. And that's very frustrating for the people that have been in rooms like that. And most everybody that's been involved in anything has been in a room like that.
Right.
It's a frustrating experience.
Well, that, if I'm thinking, you know, just so openly about opportunities that we have, and I've said this before, and a lot of this came up particularly after the death of George Floyd.
Right.
And what that did to shift us as a world, not just as a nation, but as a world, mm-hmm. the visibility of that moment where he was crying for his life. And people would come to me especially as a black man, so, Ollie, what should I be doing? Mm-hmm. Ollie, how can I make this better? And I became very clear, and I bring it up again, use your courage to be a part of change. It will mean that you will lose some friends.
Yes, it will.
You will lose some business. You will lose relationships that you have had for a long time. And if those relationships are ones to be maintained, they will come back. But if you are not practicing courage and using your privilege as a person to help this be different, I don't know what else to tell you. And so that is where I often find myself. Practicing courage is a hard thing to do.
It certainly is.
And we're in the season of Lent in the Episcopal Church and in Christianity, where it's all about self-examination and repentance and meditating on God's holy word and making these new ways forward, right? It's not about just giving up chocolate or giving up whiskey or giving up cigarettes. You know, it's about truly doing that deeper work that can lead to something new, because resurrection is what we believe as people of faith. And so courage, and the courage we find in those who've gone before us, those who are in the cemeteries, mm-hmm. we could tell stories about that. But I'm just reminded of how important that is that we practice courage and know that it is to help the human family become more of what God has intended.
Absolutely. The last 4 years have been a test, a test we have I'm afraid we have failed in many ways as a country. We have grown even further apart, and people have retreated to those places where they're most comfortable. I think that's not a new thing for people to do that, but to do it in to the degree they've done it is truly amazing to me. We're living in silos now, in echo chambers, where people only talk to those people that agree with them already, so they can hear back what they already agree with, and nobody's being challenged. And in fact, the anger of having somebody disagree with you has now been an acceptable form of behavior, that you should be mad at somebody because they disagree with you.
Right.
And if we can't, we all are different, and we all have different opinions about different things. If you just read the comments to some of my columns, you find out about just how different we can
right.
be. We have to be able to talk to each other, and we have failed. And we've got to learn to do it again,
right.
Come back to some point, and then go forward from there, where we can sit down across the table from someone who disagrees with us vehemently
right.
and still have a conversation, because at some point we're going to agree. There are things we can share. There are things we can learn from each other. We've got to learn to listen. We've got to learn to disagree, and we've got to learn to talk again.
Right.
You mentioned that you're going to lose friends, and I've lost a number of them. I'm hopeful, as I mentioned, hopeful that they will come back. But in some ways, I don't think some of them will.
Okay.
It's difficult to write a column every week. That, first of all, I'm still amazed that people read what I do write, but I try not to phone it in, but I put it out there, and it's what most writers do. You turn your guts inside out, and you pour them out on a page, and then you put it out there for everybody to look at. So it's kind of a hard thing to do, but it has the reactions I've got have both pleased and shocked me.
Okay.
And you know, it's been revealing.
Well, Dan, that your comment, your response brings to mind, you know, as a Southerner, you and I both, and something you said earlier, that we can talk openly, or we can realize that we have a shared story, but we do still have two cities of that
mm-hmm.
shared story. So
mm-hmm.
we may have the same soil,
mm-hmm.
but if you were to ask people to tell their story, the only commonality is that we're human beings and the soil that we have here in Memphis versus what perceptions one has of the other, how we see the other as sacred, as treating them like we would treat a family member. That's another level of expectation, which is where it gets uncomfortable. Equity looks like treating the stranger like you would treat your partner
mm-hmm.
or your child.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, but no. I said, equity looks like treating the other like you would treat your partner or your child. And the conversation goes quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so that's what God is calling us to do, is to treat the other, whomever the other, and otherism is our greatest sin, if we treat the other like we would treat our most beloved partner or a child, we would be in a different place.
We would be.
But that's the work. Right.
And it's not a matter of having everybody be just like you.
Right.
People are different.
Right.
Thank God people are different. It would be a very boring place if they weren't. Those silos I mentioned have got to be just colossally boring. You can't just hear the same thing over and over again and be stimulated by that.
Right.
We sit here in Crosstown right now in the window of this studio. You can look out there at that lobby, and who's going to walk through there across the course of the day? They're going to be wearing some fairly amazing things that you might not yourself put on, but and that includes a personality.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, as you said, that they shouldn't be embraced for who they are.
Right.
And then for what we can learn. And you mentioned the soil. Mm-hmm. The soil in Memphis is an incredibly rich, layered delta soil. Mm-hmm. I mean, it grows things, and it produces personality. It produces things a lot of cities don't have. There's a lot of different here. There's a lot of personality here. There's a lot of, and I use this term advisedly, and there's a lot of soul here.
Yes.
It's deep and it's rich, and you can feel it, you can hear it, and you're fortunate to be here. And just look around. If you're a writer and you walk around in Memphis for a while and you can't find something to write about, I suggest you may not be a writer. I mean, it's
right.
It's an amazing place. Just listen to it, watch it, and talk to it. I've never met anybody on a bench or anywhere that we couldn't get into a conversation, and I wasn't going to find out something really pretty fascinating about whoever that was. It might be uncomfortable fascinating, right. But it was going to be fascinating.
Right.
We've just got to talk to each other. I mean, that's where it starts.
Well, yeah. We do live in a lot of fear.
And, yeah, we
and
do.
And it does take, the other one is waiting for the other to speak, more than not. And in this soil and in the soul that we share here, it is so unreconciled. Mm-hmm. And yet we're here. Mm-hmm. We are here together, and the opportunities are endless. And I think about the diversity of people who are in cemeteries, whose markers are in cemetery, whose bodies or ashes are interred in cemeteries. And as I mentioned, as a child, I was always just drawn to the story, the tombstone, the brevity of life in some cases, where there was the marker of someone who had only lived for a day, and then the person who had lived to be more than 100 years old, and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so Elmwood is one of the many places in Memphis that I visited. There are other great places that I have enjoyed, but I know you have spent a lot of time and have a particular relationship with Elmwood.
I do.
And I'd love to have you talk about what is it about cemeteries that has drawn you to that. Did that begin for you?
Elmwood is, full disclosure, I'm a trustee at Elmwood, and it's been a joyful experience for me. I mean, a joyful experience being part of a cemetery seems like a strange thing, but I love the place. The air at Elmwood is palpable. I mean, you can feel, like most cemeteries, but you can feel what's around you in Elmwood. You can stand there in the quiet and hear, 160-something years of history.
Mm.
You can see it. You can feel it. And you don't have to. You can walk in any direction and find within a few feet something very interesting to read or see or touch. Cemeteries are tactile, too. Put your hand on a monument. It resonates. Feel the texture of it. Close your eyes and run your hand over the ridges of the carving. And feel what's there. And there's art there, there's history there.
Yes.
And Elmwood, I think, is particularly interesting because it's so many different kinds of people. And there are 75,000 souls or so there, and every one of them is a story. And they are the history of this city since 1852. Every part of this city, black and white. There's a Chinese section, there's a gypsy section, there are black and white people buried side by side.
Right.
Ben Hooks is buried not too very far from Boss Crump, which probably is pretty surprising to Boss Crump, but he's there.
God has a sense of humor.
God has a sense of humor. The Crump Monument's a pretty good example of that. It is a obelisk with a particularly sharp point at the top, as directed by Mr. Crump when it was made, because he couldn't stand pigeons. So he wanted a very sharp monument so they couldn't land on it.
Mm.
And we laugh at Elmwood because after he was gone, the Crumps married into the Pigeon family, and there are pigeons buried all around him. So there are stories like that all over the place out there. But I just love to walk there and in other cemeteries.
Yes.
My wife, Nora, and I share that, too. We've stopped along the side road on many a cemetery and just walked around and got a feel for what was there and who's there. So I recommend anybody do that. You mentioned your bike. When our kids were little, we'd put them on the back of bikes, and we'd ride our bikes from Midtown into Elmwood, and we would do rubbings and let the kids read the monuments and tell stories to each other. So, it's a special place.
The meaning for me, and I, too, have been in cemeteries with friends, with family, whenever I see a new one. If I'm driving by and there's time to stop, if I'm not in a hurry, I'll pull over and just walk into the gate if it's open, wherever it is, and look, even if it's for 10 or 15 minutes, and we'll often write down the name of it in my journal. And I am reminded of the state of the world as we know it today and the juxtaposition of the peace of the cemetery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how...
How do they meet those challenges?
How do they meet those challenges? Yeah. How have those who've gone before us, what regrets did they have? What hopes do they leave? What encouragement do they put forth for those of us who are here to make this world better than they left it?
Right.
And so I also see race and reconciliation, courage is a responsibility to our ancestors, at least the ones who wanted for there to be harmony. The ones who left this world not wanting it to be this way, that's another story. But the ones who left hoping that things would be different, even if they didn't know how.
And you mentioned courage. Again, back to Elmwood, the yellow fever epidemic.
Yes.
The martyrs of Memphis are buried at Elmwood. That when everyone fled the city that could flee the city, they didn't. They stayed in the city. And many came to the aid of the city and died helping the sick here.
Right.
There are two Episcopal priests that are buried back-to-back there that did that. One died staying here when everyone else left. And when he died, there was no one left to give communion, so a priest came from New Jersey and to take his place and was dead within 12 days, and he's buried right behind him. Those stories, 1,600 people buried in a common grave because
right.
they just had to be. The courage that people showed, the passion and compassion that they had for caring for people and for standing up to disease and to horror. I mean, it's just great stories there.
Right.
Great stories.
Well, Constance and her companions,
there are four nuns buried in the shape of a cross.
Right. The Episcopal Church, as we are here gathered in this show that is connected to the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee and thinking about Episcopal nun Constance and her companions and the impact that they made on, and as we find ourselves now in the COVID-19 pandemic, thinking about the courage that was required by those who've gone before us, we find that in a cemetery. We find the peace and the invitation there. And it also thinks of the places that bring us joy and delight and entertainment. You know, as we talked this morning about theaters and churches and
sure.
cities and special spaces and places, and you've written about some different things in that regard, but I'm always interested to hear about the sacredness or the stories or the vibe you get from theaters or churches that you might speak about.
I find myself whenever I want to get back in touch with me and anything else, I want to go into a space like that. And I think the churches and theaters have a lot in common when they're empty and when they're full, too. I mean, let's face it, we in the Episcopal Church put on a show.
Yes.
So there is a performance involved, and there is a script involved.
To the glory of God.
And to the glory of God. And everything is a certain way, and you move a certain way, and you do certain things a certain way. And in the theater, it's called a script, and we call it liturgy. But it's there. But when they're empty, when there's no one there, but if you'll forgive me, you and God, you can just go and sit in an empty space like that. And it resonates with everyone who's been there before you and what's about to appear there the coming week. If it's a theater, what'll be on stage that night? If it's church, what's going to be in that space on that Sunday? But what's there then is just you. And you and everyone else who's ever been there all at one time. And I feel that in theaters. I feel that in performance spaces. And I feel it in churches. And again, I've recommended everybody go to a cemetery. Now I'm telling you to go somewhere and be by yourself in a church or by yourself in a theater. But it sounds like I spend a lot of time with myself. Well, I do. Because
you're a writer.
Also. Well, I reflect. I guess. I don't. I guess that's what you'd call it. But Memphis has all sorts of places to do that. Memphis has big water. I've always found that big water is a place to realize how small you are and how small the huge problems you have are by comparison to the size of what's in front of you and the perpetual motion of what's in front of you. And it's not just the ocean. There's the mightiest river in this country and one of the world at one of its mightiest points right in front of the city. And we very often forget that. So It's a very good place to go and just stare at. While you're staring at it, a tree may go by that's about 70 feet long, and it's roaring by because the river moves at about 8.5 knots by Memphis at any given time. Okay. The power of that, the power of it and the perpetual motion of it and how long it's been there and how long it will be there long after whatever's bothering you at the moment has passed, it gives you a sense of place and balance, I think.
Right. Well, earlier this week, one of the things that I often do on my Sabbath day, my day of kind of rest and restoration, is to go to quiet places. Mm-hmm. So that's often cemeteries, but it's often down to the riverside.
Mm-hmm.
And to just be in that space, to walk, to sit, to nap. I often nap there and just hope that my things will be there when I wake up. But just to be in that space for a moment. But a lot of the stillness of sitting, mm-hmm. and watching the water as it changes every second,
mm-hmm.
I find hope in that.
I do too.
I actually theologically see that as the current, what I call the current of God, which is always present. So the Mississippi River, if you think about it, it's never still. It's always moving in the same way that God is always moving and God is always at work. And I see that in the water. I see that in creation. And then I see that same God in other people. And my prayer is that others see God in the other as well. You know, so if that God current, that undercurrent, that image of God always at work were to be something that we carried, the hope that you spoke about at the beginning of our time as it relates to race, the hope that I carry, it trusts that in God, not outside of God or trying to be God, but in God, things will change, which means, and God is love. So if we are putting ourselves in that story, the courage will come. But we have to put our whole selves into the water. Yep. Our whole selves into the water. Of course, there's a metaphor for baptism, which of course relates to the Christian tradition, but God as the God of all peoples and the God of all new beginnings is the God in which we believe.
And the God that created that water in front of you.
That's right.
And the power of it. And the power of where I see that is not so much in the prescribed places to see it, but in places like the river, in places like the ocean, in places like the sky, and in the shapes that go by in the sky, and in the shapes that go by on the street, and the people, and the movements they make, and the music they make, and the things they write, and the creative spirit that is so much a part of this city.
Yes.
This city is it's a creative place.
It is.
If you're challenged by poverty like this city is, you know, the where you find pleasure is in simple things. And the music forms that we've created to celebrate are born out of abject poverty and misery, but people sing.
That's right.
You know, they may take a stick and a string and a box and make an instrument out of it and sit on the porch and sing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if they can do it, so can we.
Right.
And the celebration of life, of being thankful for every day and thankful for what you can find in every day if you look, is the process, I think,
that we should be going through. That's the challenge, though, too, mm-hmm. right? Even reaching a place of gratitude has layers to it. You know, for individuals, for whatever reason, just waking up isn't a reason to be grateful. And for others, it is. Or what will come in the day, the gratitude may start to unfold. But I continue to find that people approach gratitude in a variety of ways. Sometimes they live lives with gratitude, or the things that they do toward another will be how they are expressing gratitude. But also at the same time, we are, for a variety of reasons, affluent. Even when we describe ourselves as poor, we are affluent with the gift of life. But that is hard for all the reasons, because of oppression and separation and some of the things that you've written about and stories that you've told of why people cannot be in that same place. And I'd love for you to share something that you possibly have written.
I want to share something here, if you don't mind. This is the very first column I wrote. And it's about what we've been talking about. It's about the city. It's about why I write about it. It's about why we live in it, I think, and why we find it interesting. And I'd like to share that if we just have a minute here.
Yes, thanks.
This is called All Funked Up. Face it, you're funky. This is from the dictionary. Funky, one, adjective, funkier, funkiest, informal, of music, having or using a strong dance rhythm, in particular that of funk, some excellent funky beats, modern and stylish in an unconventional or striking way. She likes wearing funky clothes. Two, strongly musty, cooked greens make the kitchen smell really funky. Rufus Thomas understood. If chicken could get funky, it would be in Memphis. Just look at the definition. It includes quintessential words from Memphis. Rhythm, beats, unconventional, striking, and yes, greens and kitchen are in there too. This part of the world, and Memphis is its capital, gave the rest of the world rhythm and blues. The beat of rock and roll, the king and court of unconventional and striking. And yes, we gave them greens and cornbread too, and grits and chitlins and fried green tomatoes and fried chicken. We gave them the stuff that sustains life and hard-to-live lives. Soul-stirring music born of abject poverty. Mouth-watering flavor from food easy to come by out in the yard, over in the field. A sense of, I can make it, I can change it, I can create it. Because the most ordinary of origins have sent such extra extraordinary gifts to the world from here. Elvis and Holiday Inns, self-service groceries and Federal Express, 3-6 Mafia and Modern Orthopedics, Stax and St. Jude, Isaac, Al, and Bebe, Clarence, Fred, and Kimmons, mm-hmm. Billy Donovan and Billy Cowell, Pitt Barbecue and Pitt Hyde. We have over the years, in no particular order and without argument, been known as the world's foremost city for cotton, hardwood, jute joints, mules, blues, rock and roll, yellow fever, soul, keelboater fights, air fate, trauma nails, and barbecue, and the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. All of that, mixed in our rich and dangerously spicy diversity, baked in our sweat through everything summers, and left to stand on the kitchen, restaurant, and church tables where we all gather, has made us one of the funkiest dishes this country serves, and people from everywhere can't wait for a taste. We're known the world over for the beat of our mojo, for the depth and breadth of our creativity, the warmth of our hospitality, and as the most giving city of our size anywhere. Yet, if you listen to us, you'd never know it. We think it's all about crime, or who the mayor is, was, or isn't, or consolidation, or taxes, or what we'll do about my street, neighborhood, school, Bible, gun. Those are real concerns needing real solutions, but people from everywhere have them. And when we bitch mightily as if they were ours uniquely, we can lose sight of what others see in us. Look at it this way. If everybody sees that funky person you're with as attractive, fun, imaginative, intelligent, capable, different, open, and loaded with potential, and you don't, you're the one who's wrong. And as John Cleese purportedly said, if you walk into a room dressed in a suit and everyone else is dressed as a chicken, you're the one who's out of place. Rufus would have understood. Work on our faults, but build on our strengths. I'm a Memphian, and I'm funky. Mm-hmm. That's us, I think.
Right.
Funky is a good word for us.
Well, I would agree for sure, and I was away from Memphis for 6 years in Charlotte, North Carolina. And one of the draws back to Memphis, of course, to the parish, Grace St. Luke's, but the city of Memphis, and I often would talk about the soul and the funk of the city.
Mm-hmm.
That it was messy and and dysfunctional and broken in all sorts of what I called all sorts of beautiful ways.
Yeah, and when you do something here, you should have to clean up after it.
Right.
And we generally do.
Right. So. And so I'm just thinking today as we reflected on race and cemeteries and sacred places and spaces and the gift of life, I'm encouraged. And would invite those who are listening to think about the importance of practicing courage. The world is in need of it. It's in need of our love, of our commitments to justice, of risk-taking, of opening ourselves fully to the human family looking and feeling and being more like the kingdom of God on earth as it is in heaven. And that I get excited. My voice even changes as I start to think about who we have an opportunity to become. And Memphis is one of the best examples of where healing can take place and where reconciliation can become a reality. But it will require a commitment from each of us, and it will require accountability on our part of those with whom we travel and our circles. And so no one is off the hook. No one can be away from this problem, even if it's harder for some versus others. And it's not about shaming. It's about being in relationship and trusting that for whatever reason, the other person wants the right thing, even if she or he doesn't know how to get there. And so this is a column, a time, a show about faith. And the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee is delighted to be in partnership with WYXR 91.7 and Faithfully Memphis. And so I say thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to welcome Dan Conaway. I am the Reverend Ollie Rencher of Grace St. Luke's Church, and we are delighted to be a part of this day. And so we say goodbye to you, and we leave you with some music as we start to sign off.
of your love. I got to have.
What you gonna do when Jesus?